Najla Said is an actress and writer with a one-woman off-Broadway show called Palestine. She grew up in one of the most influential intellectual households in America. Her father was Edward Said, a renowned professor of literature at Columbia University, better known perhaps as the most prominent voice in the West for the political and human rights of the Palestinians. He was born a Palestinian Arab, and his ties to his homeland were at the core of his own identity, both personal and professional. But for his daughter, Najla, growing up in the elite circles of New York's Upper West Side, that clear sense of identity and belonging was a lot harder to come by. She's just published a memoir called Looking for Palestine, Growing Up Confused in an Arab-American Family. And Najla Said joins us this morning. Good morning. Welcome to the program.
Good morning.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Well, it's great to have you here. You know, a lot of people seem to be surprised that the daughter of Edward Said could grow up confused about identity. But I think that growing up for you, growing up Arab-American, was a lot more complicated than it was for him.
Yeah, I mean, I think that when I set out to tell this story, I thought it was kind of interesting because I, in reflecting on my own life, realized that I had grown up in a very specific time in history, in a very specific place in history in which it was really difficult and bizarre to be an Arab, meaning I was born in 1974 and my mom's from Lebanon, and the war, the civil war in Lebanon, began about a year later. And so then my entire childhood was kind of taking place as this civil war that lasted for almost 16 years was raging in Lebanon. There was, of course, when I was about 13 or 14, my dad started appearing on television a lot, talking about the Palestinian Intifada, which had begun at that point.
That must have been the mid-80s then, right?
Yeah, sort of 87, 88-ish. Yeah. I was just about coming to be a teenager, and I had been, at that point, isolated from the Middle East for a few years. So, but in general, the perception of Arabs in this country, which is what my father wrote about a lot, and Muslims, was, you know, not the best. It was sort of those people who are violent and crazy and terrorists. And so that's what I grew up with around me. And I was trying to be American, but I couldn't find myself here either.
And then what about on your mom's side? Because your mother's family comes from Lebanon.
My mom also comes from a very intellectual family as well. So that's part of it. But my mom's family, though originally Eastern Orthodox Christian, my great-grandfather had converted to Quaker when he went to a Quaker. It was a colonial school in Lebanon. It was run by British Quakers, but he was very taken with their beliefs. So he converted. So we were one of and still are, I think, one of three Quaker Lebanese families. So now, of course, this is not at all what people assume when you say your
family's
from the
Lebanon,
East.
Right?
They don't even understand it's possible, especially Lebanon, right? Because it's so it's so defined by its religious structure. So that was confusing as well, because I knew we were Christian. And so when people would break down the war, in simple terms, it seemed like the Christian Lebanese didn't like the Palestinians. But my dad's Palestinian, so I didn't know what that meant. And my mother would say, well, we're not that. We're not those people. So every time there was like a connection or an identity that I could grab onto, there was something off about it. And so conversely, in America, I was Arab and my parents were always talking about being Arab, but the only Arabs I saw were Muslim and I wasn't Muslim. So I didn't really understand anything. And that's part of the reason I shut it out. I think it was just too confusing.
How much of your story, I mean, I think you must have written the book not just to tell your own story, but because you feel like it's relevant to other people, perhaps other young people, who are growing up with some kind of hyphenated identity. You know, we're very big in America on hyphenated identities and labels right now. And I guess, I mean, it sounds like part of what you're saying is that you didn't want a hyphenated identity.
No, and I still find it really bizarre. I feel it's sort of like an imposter when I say I'm an Arab American because I don't really know what that is. And when I was a kid, I always thought when people said Arab American, I would think of this. There's like an organization based in D.C., the Arab American Anti-Discrimination Committee, and they would always have like famous Arab Americans, and it would be like Danny Thomas and Casey Kasem and all these people that were like basically American and famous, and I didn't feel like I was as American as they were. I knew that they had, and I sort of felt like that an Arab American was a person whose family had come here a long time ago and had lived in Detroit or in that area, and had basically was completely American but had Lebanese or Syrian or Palestinian roots. And then, of course, as I said, I was not Muslim. So I don't really know what that is. And I also feel like if there's one identity that I feel is the strongest in me, it's that of being a New Yorker. So I think a lot of New Yorkers feel like they're not quite totally Americans. You know what I mean? So there's a lot of things that just felt really confusing and just mixed up. It's still like I hate when people ask me where I'm from in, you know, social situations where it's just casual conversation or what kind of a name is that? Because even just saying I'm Palestinian and Lebanese, you're waiting for a reaction and you don't – I don't know. It's still because I grew up in a time where people would be like, oh, and sort of pull away. And they sometimes still do.
Najla, I want to take you back to the summer of 1992, I think it was. It's the summer you graduated from high school, mm-hmm. and your family went to Israel for the first time. And this was a momentous trip for all of you in different ways. Can you tell us a little bit about it?
Sure. Well, in the summer before that, 1991, my father had been diagnosed with chronic lymphocytic leukemia, which he eventually passed away from. But so at that point, he had decided that he wanted to make a trip back to Palestine. He'd left when he was about 12 or 10 years old, and, you know, in 1947, and he had not been back since. So it was partly a family trip, and it was very important because he was dealing with his mortality and he wanted us to go with him and see where he came from. But it was also very strange because he was writing an article, so there was a photographer with us the entire time, and and my father kept having to do all these interviews while we were there, and it became a, you know, sort of a media event because, you know, Edward Said returning to Palestine for the first time in, you know, 50 years. It was a big deal. And the neighborhood my dad grew up in, of course, again, complicating my confusing life, was in West Jerusalem. And for those who know Israel at all, West Jerusalem now is the Israeli part of Jerusalem.
Right.
And so I still have this conversation all the time. People ask, what part of Palestine are you from? And I would say Jerusalem, and they'll say, oh, East Jerusalem. And I'll say, no, West Jerusalem.
Right.
And they're like, no, that's where the Jews are. And I'm like, but not when I, you know, my dad grew up in a sort of upper middle class neighborhood. It's still that way. I think, like, I'm sure, like, Ariel Sharon lives around the corner. You know, it's a very posh neighborhood. Still, it has these big houses. It's beautiful, but it's Israeli.
But I mean, just what you're saying, you know, there's a moment on that trip you write about, and I'm not going to get this right, but your dad kind of turned to you and said, you know, it's our generation that did this. You know, so mm-hmm. suddenly you're looking at all these little kids around the streets in West Jerusalem, East Jerusalem, mm-hmm. Arab kids and Israeli kids, and they see each other as enemies because of conflicts and things that your dad's generation couldn't solve. And did he feel guilty about that?
Well, what he actually said, which I think you paraphrased beautifully, he said that he's like, our generation was too close to it. I think that that's what he meant, that his generation and the generation of my grandparents was too attached to all these actual events that had created this division and this conflict, and that my generation, hopefully growing up in a world where, you know, for example, if someone is my age and they're Israeli, they were just born there. So at what point does the this is mine, not your – because I've never lived there. I was mm-hmm. not born there. So it's a very awkward situation. And he was hoping that perhaps my generation would be more able to sort of solve the problem and learn how to share and live together. And that was a little overwhelming to me. Yes.
Well, and in the meantime, on that trip, you were by then – going through anorexia. So you mm-hmm. talk about going through, I don't mean to laugh. I mean,
no, it's fine.
You write also amusingly about something that was obviously deeply painful, but on this entire trip, I mean, you were barely eating.
Yeah, I was not eating at all. And I think in this context, it was very much a sort of physical thing that showed how I didn't belong and how different I was. Because the culture, you know, we were there on this trip and everyone was inviting us to meals. Arabs are known for being... Yeah, their hospitality and eating and feeding. And that's how you show love. And you don't say no when someone offers you food. Of course, I would say no, I don't want, no thank you. And I would sit there and stare at the plate. And then, or I'd give my brother my food. And I didn't do it on purpose, of course. But it was certainly an unconscious thing that I was feeling, which was that I am American. I'm Western. I have this Western problem where I don't eat. And I'm sort of making myself not fit in here. And
so it's a complicated dance of you were both rejecting identities that you felt were being thrust on you. And at the same time, there's such self-hatred in anorexia, of course, you know, guilt and rage at yourself, probably for not being able to fit in, for not being able to be, I don't know, the perfect daughter of Edward Said.
Exactly. And then I was growing up with, a certain group of people. You know, I went to this very, as I say in the book, a very WASPy school when I was a kid. And everyone was sort of seemed blonde and had a small frame. And so I associated my tall, lanky, big bones with being, you know, first of all, being different and being not able to fit in. So that was part of it, too. And I just felt like, well, maybe if I can be skinny, no one will notice that I'm different. And also, in a weird way, I kind of wanted to go away. I wanted to disappear. Mm-hmm. I was like, I just don't want to be here. It's, don't notice me. Don't notice me.
So one thing we haven't really talked about is the kind of hostility that you in particular have had to deal with from other people and their assumptions about your dad and also about what it means to be Arab American. For instance, there's a story you tell about, there's a famous photo taken of your dad. I think it was on a visit to, was it Gaza?
It was in South Lebanon.
When he's throwing a rock at an Israeli guard tower. I don't remember that. I don't remember what happened. What's your memory?
Oh, you're so lucky. it was 3 years before he passed away. It was 2000. And we went to Lebanon, and it was a family trip, and it was not a political trip in any way. But we went in June, and in May of 2000, the Israelis left South Lebanon. They had been occupying the south of Lebanon up until then for about 30 years. And so they had just gone, and it was, quote unquote, liberated. So a friend of ours or some friends of ours were like, do you want to go to the south and visit? And there was this place where they had set up a sort of symbolic place where there was an Israeli checkpoint tower that was abandoned because the Israelis had left South Lebanon. And they'd set up a little area in front of it where there was people would come and pick up stones and throw them at the tower. And it was meant to be like celebrating the fact that they got rid of the Israeli occupation. So we went there and my brother was like, oh, these guys don't know how to play baseball. They don't know how to throw a ball. The rocks don't land anywhere near the tower. So he decided to show us how to throw a rock. And he picked it up and he threw it. And it went very far and very fast. And then my dad started doing it with him because, you know, they were kind of competitive. And there happened to be a photographer with us, as always. And he took a picture of it. And by the time we got back to Beirut, which is literally 2 or 3 hours later, it ended up being sold to sort of Agence France-Presse, which is like international photo agency. And it was all over the internet and all over the world and being printed in the New York Post and saying, oh, Edward Said, this terrorist person who's throwing rocks at Israeli soldiers. And when he passed away, many publications, including the New York Times, that became a lot of his legacy. Was in 2000, he was famous for throwing a rock, and it was just heartbreaking because it was ridiculous. That's not what happened. I mean, he did throw the rock, but he threw it at nothing, and it was heartbreaking because the New York Post picked it up and said all these horrible things about, you know, what a I guess mm-hmm. terrorist is the only word I can come up with. That was the idea, that my dad was this violent person. And my dad spoke only of human rights, social justice, and a nonviolent resistance. So it was very disheartening because in many ways that's how he was remembered. And for the next few years I would meet people. And then it was a big scandal at Columbia where he taught, and all these people were like, you fire that man. He's horrible. And Columbia had to make a statement in support of him. And so for a few years after that, whenever I would meet people, they'd be like, oh, your dad, the guy that threw the stone. And I just thought, what? Mm. So that story is intense to me because it's partly shows what it's like to grow up in general in the public eye.
Well, and also, I mean, again, sticking with the thinking about anger.
Right.
For some reason, the next story, the image I have in my mind, it's from near the end of your book, and mm-hmm. You're back in Lebanon. This might have been fairly recently, and mm-hmm. there's an Israeli bombing strike. There's warplanes
right.
that are going overhead, and you have a complicated reaction.
Yep.
Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. There's this thing about bombs. They are so frightening. You can't watch a movie or put a sound effect in a play and really replicate what that feels like and what it sounds like, because it is the loudest sound. And I guess psychologically, because you know it is a bomb, mm-hmm. the reaction to it is paralyzing. And it's incessant. And the planes keep going overhead and the bombs keep going off. And then you'll hear boom, 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 like rifles. And it's so frightening because you don't know where to go or what to do or where they're coming from. So what happens is you get insanely angry. And I think a lot of people in America during 9/11 can understand this feeling. You feel like you're being attacked. So you get angry and you just want the people who are attacking you to die. And you just start screaming. So I had this moment where I'm like, I hate you, and cursing out all these Israeli planes and feeling such anger. And then getting over it because I'm American and I eventually left. And I know, I know lots of nice Israelis who don't believe this is the right thing to do. I live in New York. I was on the phone every day with my Jewish therapist, and she was, very like, I miss you. You're going to be okay. I'm so sorry this is happening. We'll get you out. So it was very odd.
Yeah.
But I could only have the luxury of having that logical, that sort of calming down and rationalizing the situation because I do live on the outside and because I could leave and I had somewhere to go. And so I was basically saying that when you live there, whether you're Israeli or Arab, and you're constantly, the only thing you know of these other people is this feeling that they bring out in you when they're attacking you, you're not going to stop hating each other.
Najla, thank you so much for joining us today. Actress and writer Najla Saeed has a one-woman off-Broadway show called Palestine and a new memoir, Looking for Palestine, Growing Up Confused in an Arab-American World.